National distribution of Smart City is made possible by the listeners of WKNO in Memphis and by the Hyde Family Foundation, investing in enlightened leadership, transforming the future of children and community.
I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Imagining new uses for outdated railroads is creating exciting new opportunities for central cities. In New York, an elevated railway, now abandoned, cuts through 22 blocks of Chelsea and Lower Manhattan. A group called Friends of the High Line and Mayor Bloomberg are behind the move to convert the railway into a wild, natural linear landscape for New Yorkers. In Atlanta, there's a similar effort underway called the Beltline, but instead of 22 blocks, the Beltline embraces 22 miles of track circling the central city. Friends of the Beltline have proposed an ambitious plan for its conversion to parks, transit, greenways, and new mixed-use development. We'll find out about the High Line in New York and the Beltline in Atlanta today on Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Joshua David is a writer and Chelsea resident who in August 1999 found himself at a community meeting discussing the option of converting the elevated CSX railroad tracks to a garbage conduit. Some of his neighbors wanted to demolish the tracks, but Joshua and painter Robert Hammond had a different vision. Together, they formed Friends of the High Line. Joshua, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Well, thank you for having me.
Tell us about the High Line. What is it and how did it come to be?
The High Line is an elevated rail structure that's out of use currently. It runs through 22 blocks of Manhattan. It was built in the 1930s to elevate dangerous freight rail traffic off the streets of New York. At that time, there were so many fatalities because of the street-level rail traffic that the avenues were called Death Avenue. And this was the result of a long period of negotiation between the city and the state and the railroad to solve that problem. And it was used from the 1930s to the 1960s and then fell out of use. And parts of it were torn down in the 60s, and the remainder has been standing since 1980 without any rail use on it, and it's covered with beautiful meadow grasses and wildflowers, an eerie, tranquil, self-sown landscape atop a steel structure, a magnificent industrial steel structure that cuts through the middle of city blocks and offers incredible views of the Hudson River and the Midtown skyline and the historic blocks that surround the structure.
Tell me how New Yorkers want to reuse the High Line.
New Yorkers, particularly a group called Friends of the High Line, which I started with another individual who lives in the neighborhood in 1999, have proposed taking this industrial structure and turning it into an elevated park or walkway using the Rails to Trails program. There's only one other structure that has been converted in a similar fashion in the world, and that's in Paris. It's called the Promenade Plantée. And we want to do something similar in New York, which is create access points up to the elevated structure. It's about 30 feet off the ground, and allow people to move through the city in this from this new perspective on top of this structure.
How did you discover the potential of the project? How did you get involved?
I live down the street from the High Line, as does the other co-founder, Robert Hammond. He lives in a different part of the neighborhood. And we both separately, we didn't know each other, we both separately became interested in this industrial artifact that cut through our neighborhoods and began to research it. And when we found out that it was unbroken for 22 blocks, we thought that was an incredible opportunity to create a one-of-a-kind open space that there's nothing like it in the United States. And we happened to meet at a community board meeting where the structure was being discussed. At that time, there was a strong movement to tear it down. And we happened to sit next to each other and started chatting about the project, and we decided that this was too valuable an opportunity for New York City to miss. And so we started Friends of the High Line with the idea of converting it to a park.
Was it a group of neighbors that wanted to tear it down?
It was underlying property owners. There were a number of property owners who'd purchased land under the structure with that encumbrance there, knowing that they had a rail structure over their property. So they got it at very low prices. When the train stopped running, they wanted to take advantage of their development rights over the structure, and so began to seek to have it demolished so that they could build on their property.
Which would have made them very rich.
In many cases, yes.
What is their reaction? What's the reaction of the property owners to this proposal?
one of the interesting aspects of the proposal is a very interesting and innovative approach that the city of New York has taken to address the needs of these property owners at the same time that they seek to create a new public open space on the High Line. Initially, when we started Friends of the High Line, the city of New York was in favor of demolition as well. But when Mayor Bloomberg took office, he took a fresh look at the project at our request and began to realize that this really was a great opportunity for the city, both to create an open space and also to add value to the neighborhood in a way that would create new tax revenues and generate new revenues for the city. And so he, with his director of city planning, Amanda Burden, began to look at ways you could plan for this neighborhood in a way that would create a fabulous new open space, but also address the needs of property owners. And what the Department of City Planning, under the leadership of Commissioner Burden, did was create a special district that will allow the underlying property owners to move their development rights away from this site. So they'll be able to sell their development rights to other designated sites in the neighborhood. So in that manner, their needs have been addressed in the larger plan. It's a very interesting technique, and it was one that was instrumental in the saving of Grand Central Terminal many years ago.
How does it work?
It creates a new special zoning district, and which functions, it has a lot of different objectives, but one of them is to further the reuse of the High Line. And in doing so, if you own property underneath the structure, you are empowered to sell the development rights that are above the structure to designated sites in the West Chelsea area. And so partly because of this, the property owners have come on board with the project and no longer are seeking demolition.
In Paris, is the land underneath the elevated structure used for shops?
Yes, they have. There are arcades underneath the Promenade Plantée, and there are a number of craft studios and shops that are located underneath the structure. The New York structure is a little bit different from the one in Paris. It's a little newer. It was built in the 30s. The one in Paris was built probably about 50 years earlier than that. The Parisian viaduct is right up against the sidewalk, so it has a lot of street front spaces underneath it. An interesting thing about the High Line was it was constructed at a time when a number of other elevated rail structures in New York were being torn down, because it was considered that having elevated structures over the streets created a negative condition. It made it darker. And so when they built the High Line, they built it on the inside of the city block. So it only crosses over cross streets. It doesn't go down a long length of avenue. So it doesn't have the same kind of spaces directly facing the sidewalk that the one in Paris has. That said, it's one of our main objectives to promote exciting, interesting uses in the private spaces under the High Line and also in the public spaces under the High Line where it crosses streets, to create a dynamic and safe and well-lit environment that makes the spaces underneath as enticing as the spaces up above.
Tell me how a volunteer group, I presume, the Friends of the High Line, put together a vision that was compelling enough to turn neighborhood sentiment and City Hall sentiment around.
Well, I'm glad that you've asked that. It's really an interesting project in that it seemed so dreamlike and such a difficult project to achieve at the very beginning, and yet momentum built so quickly behind it. And I think part of that came from the structure itself and the opportunity it presented. It just captured people's imagination as soon as you started talking about it. But a couple of the things that were interesting that we were able to do to really make it move forward in a compelling way was there's so many community projects are about stopping something. And in one way, this was about stopping the demolition of the High Line at the beginning. But we never concentrated on the negative message of demolition, but rather on the positive vision of building something great, making something incredible for New York that would harness all of the creative energy that's in the city. And partly because of that, we were able to appeal to a different kind of constituency than often gets involved in community projects. We had incredibly strong support from the art community and the art gallery community. There are many art galleries located in the West Chelsea neighborhood around the High Line, and they don't often come out for projects like this, for community-based projects, but this was something that really spoke to them and spoke to the artists they represented. So we were able to bring artists into the mix. The other thing that was very positive about the organization is neither Robert nor me, neither of us had any previous experience in community organizing or in architecture or in preservation or in open space development. We were totally new to this, and because of that, we came with no preconceived notions about how you start a project like this, and we tended to bring in a lot of people from the outside, the best that we could find in various different fields, whether it be graphic design, whether it be economic studies, whether it be planning, whether it be architecture. We tended to draw the very best that we could find to us. And those people tended to self-identify because of the exciting nature of the project. They came to us and offered us their services. So we didn't really have any great grand vision. We didn't have this all planned out in advance. We just really raised the flag and said, hey, this is something great that needs to be done. And people rallied around us. And so I hope it will stand as an example to other people in other communities who have something like this that they want to accomplish, that if you just, you don't need to know how to do it. You don't need to have done it before. You don't need to know anybody else who knows how to do it. But you do need to get out there and raise the flag and say, hey, this is a good idea.
You've had people like yourself, you're a writer, Kevin Bacon, Martha Stewart, Edward Norton, Diane von Furstenberg, all signed on to this project and helped raise money for it. What role does celebrity support play in getting a project like this off the ground?
It's one piece among many that is incredibly valuable to us. It brings us attention. One of the things that's interesting about this project and the celebrities that are involved is, like individuals in other fields, they've come to us and have self-identified as being interested in the project. Edward Norton is one of our supporters and now actually on our board of directors, and he called me up out of the blue after reading an article about us in the New Yorker magazine and said, hey, I want to be part of this. Kevin Bacon and Kira Sedgwick, they were just on a list, a big list of people that we sent out a mailing to, and they came to us. We didn't have to wrangle them or pull them into our organization. They came to us. And Diane von Furstenberg as well. This is something that goes through her neighborhood, so she cared about it. So it really makes a big difference when people like this actually have a passion about a project, then they come back over and over and over again, and the public profile that surrounds them comes to the project as well, and it is hugely, hugely helpful. Not all communities are as fortunate as we are in New York City, in this neighborhood in New York City, to have such a pool of high-profile individuals working and living right around the area. But I would certainly encourage anybody who's working on a project like this to tap into whatever high-profile individuals are available to them, particularly ones who really might care about the project themselves.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Joshua David. He is co-founder of Friends of the High Line, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the preservation and reuse of the High Line, a 22-block-long historic elevated rail structure on the west side of Manhattan. Joshua, talk to me a little bit about the relationship between the Friends of the High Line and City Hall. You've said raise the flag, but how did you really initiate those discussions with City Hall that allowed you then to raise the flag at City Hall and present a different option for the High Line?
Well, I'll go at this a little bit backwards, because I do want to lead by saying we, Friends of the High Line, really has an extraordinary relationship with the Bloomberg administration, the city of New York, and the city council right now. And I think it really is a great model of the way private nonprofit organizations and city governments can work together to drive a project forward in a really successful way. One of the reasons we have so much momentum right now is is because the City of New York and the City Council are so open to working with Friends of the High Line. That didn't happen by chance. That didn't just happen out of the blue. Both the Friends of the High Line and the city have worked very hard to develop this relationship. When we began, there was a different mayor. Mayor Giuliani and his administration had favored tearing the High Line down. And we sensed very early on that there wasn't going to be a lot of traction in bringing a change of position from that administration. But it was nearly over, and the term limits meant that Mayor Giuliani couldn't be reelected. So we sought the support of all of the mayoral candidates during the next election. And it's something I would certainly recommend to any other organization that's trying to achieve something like this, is election time is a great time to build support from candidates who are going to later be in power. And Bloomberg was among the most supportive of the candidates who we enlisted support from. And when he took office, he said, we'll take a fresh look at this. And we worked very hard to answer all of the questions that they had. The questions that they mostly had were, what does this mean for the economy of New York City? At the time, we were in post 9/11. Nobody knew what the economic outlook for New York City was going to be. It appeared pretty bleak. So they really wanted to know how this worked financially. And so we commissioned an economic feasibility study that looked at the way that parks and open spaces add value to communities and increase property values. And when that happens, it generates increased tax revenues for the city. And by doing this this study, we caught their attention. We showed that not only was it going to be a really fabulous open space, but it was going to contribute to the city in other very important and tangible ways. And that went a long way in beginning to form the foundation of a strong and positive relationship with City Hall.
You've selected a designer for the project. Tell me about the design competition and how the final selection was made.
We actually had two competitions. One was an ideas competition in 2003, which was open to everybody. We had 720 entries from all over the world, which we exhibited in Grand Central Terminal. That was really just to generate really creative ideas and visions for the project. They didn't have to be buildable. They didn't have to be financially rational. And we got some fantastic, wild ideas out of that competition. One was turning the entire thing into a swimming pool. One was building a roller coaster on it, all sorts of wild and fun ideas, but not anything that we were planning on building. Then the following year in 2004, we had a serious design competition, which we did in partnership with the City of New York. And the criteria for that were much, much stronger. You had to have a team of engineers and lighting consultants and security consultants and landscape architects and architects. And the teams that were competing were very complex organizations in and of themselves. And we started with 52 entries and gradually made it down to 4 before the most serious competitive work was done. And we ended up selecting an incredible team. All 4 of the finalist teams were amazing. Any one of them would have done a fantastic job with the High Line. But the one that we ended up selecting, whose work is actually now on view at the Museum of Modern Art in a great exhibition, they're called Field Operations. That's the landscape architect lead, and Diller, Scafidio, and Renfro, the architect lead. And they're 2 firms working together with a large group of consultants behind them. And they have a fantastic and very unusual vision for the conversion of the structure, which has really captivated New Yorkers, and there's a tremendous amount of excitement about it.
You have these wonderful illustrations and team statements on your website, mm-hmm. from the 4 teams who were finalists, and mm-hmm. then, of course, the winning team statement I thought was quite beautiful, and in it they refer to something called agritecture. I want you to tell me what agritecture is.
I'm glad you've asked that, and I'm glad you mentioned the website, because I do hope people will go to it. It's www.thehighline.org. And agritecture, in that portion of the website that looks at the 4 finalist plans, is something that Field Operations and Diller, Scafidio, and Renfro coined to describe the way the hard pathways and the planted landscape will work on the High Line. It's a merging of hardscape and plant materials into a single system, so you don't have a path running down the center of two planted beds, but rather the path and the plantings are merged into one system. In this case, the way that they're achieving that is through a series of concrete planks. They're similar dimensions to wooden planks, but they're made of concrete, and they taper down to points at the ends and dive into the planted beds. So the plantings come up between the cracks of some of the hardscape. So there are places where the planks are close together and create a smooth, continuous, wheelchair accessible walking path, but at edges and in various places the landscape comes up through them. This is partly in response to the really amazing landscape that's up on the High Line right now. There's a beautiful, beautiful self-seeded wildscape of plants that have just grown naturally in this very barren atmosphere over the past 20 years. And it's an aesthetic that all of us felt very strongly about preserving. And this approach to it, it really is very exciting.
The work of the design team seems to be guided by four simple ideas. Keep it simple, keep it quiet, keep it wild, and keep it slow. Is that the formula for the High Line needed to act as counterpoint to the energy of the streets in New York?
I think I'm very glad you pointed out those words, because they are things that we return to again and again. What's so special about going up on the High Line right now, which I have to insert here, is it's private property and you shouldn't go up there except by permission. You get arrested. It's trespassing. But if you are fortunate enough to be able to go up there with Friends of the High Line or the railroad, it's a place in the city, sewn into the city's fabric. But yet it's very much a place apart. It's elevated. You don't hear the street sounds. You don't have to cross the streets. It's a world in and of itself. And the design team really has sought to maintain that distinction between the world of the High Line and the world of the city around it. It's related to the city, and yet it's a place apart. And maintaining that balance is perhaps one of the most complex elements of the project. Where do you allow a connection to a neighboring building? Where do you come down to the street? To what degree do you allow businesses to operate next to the High Line and have connections to it? All of those questions are things that we're looking at very carefully, wanting both to create a vibrant and exciting place on the High Line where people want to go, so you need a certain amount of programming around it and on it, but also maintaining this sense that it is a place apart, a retreat, a world of its own.
Joshua, quickly tell me when construction is expected to begin and how long will it take?
We're proposing to break ground at the end of this year, 2005. We just won a major federal victory that would ultimately help allow that to happen. The Surface Transportation Board in Washington issued a certificate of interim trail use for the project, which was one of our biggest remaining hurdles to beginning construction. So we're aiming at 2005, and with a wrap of the first section, which is the southernmost five blocks, in late 2007, early 2008.
It's exciting. Joshua, thanks for being our guest on Smart
City. Thank you
City.
So much for having us.
Joshua David is a writer based in New York and co-founder of Friends of the High Line. After a short break, we'll return to talk to Otis White about cities that are insisting that the music be turned down. And in the second half of our show, we'll talk about another exciting rail line conversion, the Beltline in Atlanta. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he provides us with urban insights from around the country. Otis, anyone over 40 who lives in a city has probably complained at least once about the really loud bass systems at work in automobiles traveling around the city.
Yeah, that thumpa sound that you hear from cars, it is just... They really are. They're kind of audio vandals in the sense that they're sort of hijacking your conversation as you walk down the street.
You're giving away your age.
Well, this is one of those things that really has it makes urban life more difficult. And unfortunately, the audio industry is working very hard to make our lives more miserable. The good news is that cities are starting to fight back. The most recent and encouraging sign is that in the state of Florida, they passed a new state law. Now, this was sort of positioned as a highway safety bill because they said these systems are so dangerous you can't hear sirens, that they're so loud. But the state of Florida has passed a new law that says that if a police officer is 25 feet away from your car and he can hear your stereo, you get a $30 ticket. Now, this is a little different from most of these regulations because many of them require that you actually measure the sound coming from the car. Nope. If the police officer can hear it and he or she is 25 feet away, you get a ticket. In reporting this, the Miami Herald, about this new law, telling folks about it, they actually consulted some medical doctors, and they say not only is this sort of bad for urban life, it's really, really bad for the people who have these systems. Because when you do this low frequency, when you put these low frequency speakers in your car, really within an hour, it can begin to damage your hearing. So over the long term, it can reduce your ability to hear even normal conversations in a crowded room. So, you know, the people who are riding around with these thumpa systems in their car are going to get a ticket. They're going to spend a lot of money to get those speakers in there, and they're going to go deaf in the bargain. So there is kind of justice in the world, Carol.
Oh, you're cruel. Otis, we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Carol.
You're listening to Smart City. Ryan Gravel was a graduate student at Georgia Tech when he saw the potential of the Beltline surrounding in-town Atlanta. He sent his graduate thesis explaining the opportunity the site offered for in-town redevelopment to then-City Councilwoman Kathy Woolard. She threw her support behind the project, and she and Ryan teamed up to form Friends of the Beltline. Kathy is now its executive director, and Ryan is its director of design and planning. Ryan, Kathy, thanks for being our guest on Smart City. Ryan, describe the proposed Beltline.
The Beltline is a 22-mile loop of, it's a transit greenway around the city of Atlanta, about 2 or 3 miles out in every direction from downtown Atlanta. It uses some old freight Beltline railroads that circle the city and converts that into a linear park with a streetcar transit or trolley type transit vehicle, and also a bicycle and pedestrian path, and connects over 40 historic neighborhoods in the city, city parks, schools, shopping districts, as well as thousands of acres of redevelopable land that would formerly industrial and commercial properties that are already developing in many parts of town, already developing into the dense mixed use residential districts that people want to live in. The city of Atlanta lost population in the 1970s and 80s, and in the 90s started to trickle in. But now we're gaining 5,000 to 8,000 new residents a year, and those people have to live somewhere. And there's a desire for a more urban lifestyle in Atlanta, and this sort of accommodates that growth in a way that's transit-oriented and allows access to parks and trails and transit and everything else that people want.
You mentioned a new trolley system. Would that be an introduction of a new transportation mode in Atlanta?
Yes, this would be Atlanta currently has MARTA, which is a heavy rail system, a subway when it's downtown, and then as it heads out of town, it becomes an elevated system. The Beltline would be more of a trolley-type vehicle, like the streetcars in San Francisco, the old trolley in New Orleans along St. Charles Avenue. Be much more like that, where you can walk across the tracks, more neighborhood-friendly, but would connect to MARTA at each of the four compass points. So it would, the MARTA study that's ongoing now shows that it would pump tens of thousands of new riders into the MARTA system. So it both complements the existing transit system that we have, but also puts more neighborhoods with direct access into the MARTA system.
Mm-hmm. You came up with this idea for the Beltline as a student at Georgia Tech. What first got you interested in the project?
When I was in school, I was studying, I was doing a joint degree graduate program with architecture and city planning, and I was studying how the design of infrastructure systems influences urban development. It's sort of a design problem. It's also a big picture sort of planning problem. So it ties those two fields together really well. But in the same way that the old streetcars, when they were extended out of downtown Atlanta, created the sort of bungalow single-family neighborhoods that so many people in Atlanta love, in the same way that the interstate highway system created a whole different kind of growth, how do you design an infrastructure system that encourages the rebirth of the central city neighborhoods? When you look at Atlanta, Atlanta doesn't have a waterfront or a river or anything like that. Atlanta's a railroad town. We're built on railroads. The railroads are sort of our riverfront. And when you look at the railroads in the city, you see this loop of old abandoned railroads that really tie all these inner city neighborhoods together in a really incredible way. And so how do you design the reuse of that corridor as something that is positive and beneficial for the neighborhoods, encourages a kind of private investment that creates the schools and jobs and retail and parks that are within walking distance to all the neighborhoods. It really pulls all that together. So I was looking at how the design of infrastructure systems accomplishes multiple public goals. In this case, transit mobility, parks, greenway, air quality, economic development, a really broad array of problems.
Kathy, you were president of the city council when Ryan approached you with this idea?
Actually, I was not president yet. I was a council member, and I chaired the city's transportation committee at the time, and that's how I ended up hearing from Ryan about the project.
And what captivated you about the project?
Well, it's sort of an interesting story. I think I had invited the transportation agencies in their region to come and do a presentation for my committee about future transportation projects, and it became very clear to me that the city of Atlanta did not have its own proactive plan for what it wanted to do relative to transportation. There was a lot of transportation getting ready to be done to the city by, you know, regional and state agencies. And so I was very frustrated that we had not really engaged in this as a policy discussion. And I went back to my office and I thought, we've got to figure this out. And I was opening my mail and Ryan's project literally fell out into my lap. And so I called him up and said, come down and tell me what this is. This looks really interesting. And I was very captivated by the project and resolved that I would do everything I could do to make it a reality. And then I later became president and I continued working on the project. So for about 4 years, my staff and I and Ryan and a bunch of people who stepped forward to help us kind of untangled what is essentially a very complex project, but also a very simple idea.
What was the initial reaction from the transportation agencies that you had in to tell you about their plans that frustrated you? I mean, did they embrace it immediately? Did they resist it? Not invented here? What was their reaction?
Well, there was a good bit of sort of benign resistance. I think people thought that maybe I would lose interest or, you know, that it would just sort of go away. So they sort of patted me on the head and let me keep talking about it. But as we talked more and more with community leaders and neighborhood leaders and people who are interested in green space and transportation and quality of life in in-town neighborhoods, the project really took hold. And then, again, through the help of a number of people who really helped us figure out how to fund it and how, you know, sort of the roadmap to getting federal transportation dollars, we were able to really get the project off the ground and attract attention. We got some money in our regional transportation plan to fund the multi-use trail. We also got Congressman Lewis helped us get money to do a study on the feasibility. Then we had a private developer buy one of the segments, and that really, I think, kind of lit a fire under it when, you know, all of the studies came forward and said this thing is feasible, but somebody actually bought part of the infrastructure and indicated an interest in using it for those purposes, then that really blew the doors off of the project.
The bulk of the conversation prior to the Beltline regionally in the Atlanta region was about how to move people from the far-flung areas of town into downtown and back home at the end of the day, not really about how to move people around within the central core of the city where people generally live at densities that would support transit, are willing to pay for transit, want to ride transit, and have been paying for transit for 30 years through the MARTA system. So I think the Beltline really has changed the dynamic of the conversation. Obviously, there's still a bigger, broader conversation regionally about bringing people in from further out areas, but there's now a conversation locally about how to move people within the city that wasn't there before.
It's unusual, unfortunately, to have a conversation about a major new transportation infrastructure, and at the same time have a conversation about development of neighborhoods, development of green space, development of new connections. I mean, those things so often are segregated, you know, in the hands of various agencies, and they never come together. Is it the coming together of all of these, you know, this multiplicity of issues that so excites people in Atlanta and has allowed this project to move forward so quickly?
Yeah, I think so. There's a lot to love about this project, and if you're somebody who really focuses on green space, or if you're somebody who is a bicycle rider, or if you're somebody who really wants to ride transit, came from another place and really misses that here, or if you're a real estate developer that is looking for, you know, the best potential for redevelopment, you know, there's a way for you to find a piece of this project and participate. That's also the big challenge of the project, obviously, is to resolve all of these diverse interests into a common theme. The project lends itself to that, but you still have to go through the process of doing that.
But I think the future of not just transit, but any sort of smart growth kind of project in the country is going to be, you're going to have to be able to deal with a multiple array of issues. And, you know, transit line is not just a transit line. It's an economic development initiative. And likewise, a highway is the same. It's not just a highway. There are other implications for the implementation of that project. If we can capitalize on that and make them and sort of use the project to accomplish multiple public goals, I think that's the future of smart growth in the United States, because we've got a limited amount of money to spend on these kinds of projects, and we need to get the most bang for a buck on those things.
Kathy, your political experience has obviously helped move the Beltline more quickly than it otherwise would have. What are the political hurdles that remain?
Oh, you know, name a jurisdiction and there's probably a political hurdle there. We our next real political conversation is passing legislation that would allow us to create a tax allocation district to fund the project. A tax allocation district is basically a defined geographical area that would allow us to freeze the taxes at the level that they are today and then capture the incremental increase that comes with redevelopment and use it for infrastructure projects within those geographic boundaries. And that would allow us to purchase the infrastructure, build the transit and the multi-use trail and some other amenities like affordable housing that we want to make sure get in there. That needs to pass through our city council, our school board, and our county commission. Also trying to work through the federal level to access federal funds for the transportation piece will be part of the conversation, and then working with our various regional and statewide transportation agencies to gain their cooperation on the usage of these lines. So it is a very political project in that it touches lots of different political jurisdictions.
What kind of funding will it require? Is there a total?
Well, there are totals. the recent total, which includes a huge expansion of green space on the line and off the line, about 1,400 acres, takes the price tag up to about $3 billion. The transit price, and again, this is a big swing of an estimate, is probably somewhere between $800 million and $1 billion, depending on the type of transit and routes and a couple of engineering problems along the way.
How much do you expect to capture from the tax allocation district if all goes well?
What's the number, Ryan? I forget.
It's $1.5 billion.
Yeah, about half of that.
Over 20 years. So it'll more than pay for the Beltline project itself.
Mm-hmm.
And then the additional costs of new parks, potential new connecting MARTA stations, incentives for affordable housing, and other goals of the city, those will add more cost to it. But if you leverage for federal dollars in those different categories, we could get there.
I know Atlanta, when Shirley Franklin took office, she found a city that was not in great fiscal shape. Have you had pushback on this in a sense of, wait a minute, we have other needs, we have needs that have been in the hopper for a long time? You know, how can you possibly be talking about something this bold and this big, given our fiscal condition?
The mayor's done a great job in the last 4 years of righting the finances of this city and operating within means and kind of undertaking the projects we need to do. Now, I don't think there's a city in America that wouldn't want more money, but one of the things that's very unique about this project is there's a big price tag to it, but there's about a $50 billion return over the lifetime of the project, 20 years or so, to the general fund. So we're really talking about building the city in a really transformational kind of way. We're putting into place an infrastructure that will allow us to grow by building new residences, building new retail, creating jobs and transit for decades into the future. So in a sense, we're really sort of building an infrastructure for our own growth. And that requires an investment, but it's an investment that's very, very concentrated along something that we feel very confident will produce that return. It's not speculative at all.
In terms of the green space, 1,400 acres of green, that's a lot of green. What do you think the significance is of the connected nature of the green space that is imagined as a greenway rather than a park?
It's certainly more valuable to have a park system where bigger parks are connected by linear parks and trails to create a network across the city proper, but also ultimately across the region. I think that's more valuable from a recreational, even alternative transportation standpoint, certainly from the public health. The CDC has shown that communities that live adjacent to transit and trails are healthier communities because it encourages people to walk, which cuts down on their risk of diabetes and heart disease and obesity. So certainly if parks are connected by linear parks and transit and trails, that certainly makes a better system.
Because these rail corridors have been somewhat of a blight over the years, there hasn't been a lot of redevelopment immediately adjacent to the corridor. So in fact, the land available for preservation kind of orients itself along this corridor.
Kathy Friends of the Beltline uses the tagline, "Change the way we think about Atlanta." What is the significance of that? Do Atlantans need to change the way they think about their city?
The citizens of the city of Atlanta have actually grown very sophisticated over the last decade or so about how they would like to see the city built, the walkability of it, the greenness and sustainability of it, the opportunities for additional transit, I think have become part of the community dialogue in an amazingly rapid way. We certainly need to change it in terms of the region, though, because sprawl is a huge problem here in the Atlanta region, and we continue to allow land use patterns to develop and then continually engage in this transportation dialogue about how we bail communities out after these bad decisions have been made.
Mm-hmm.
I think this project really starts to shift the dialogue and to show by example that you can, build good quality communities with some density, with transportation, and plan for recreation opportunities along the way that make it a very desirable place to live. And I think Atlanta is really, in our redevelopment projects overall, but with the Beltline in particular, really setting the standard for this region and demonstrating that that can work.
Have you modeled Friends of the Beltline after other such groups around the country or in Atlanta?
Ryan can talk a little bit about this too, but there are a number of projects that are kind of similar. I think ours is a bit larger and kind of aggregates everything anybody's doing into one big project. But the Midtown Greenway project in Minneapolis has put in a bike path on existing rail corridor and is working on the transit piece. So we're looking at what they've been doing, what they've done in Portland, being very innovative about how they've used private funding to build their transit system and create redevelopment. All of those things have been models for us about how to mobilize people, how to fund it, how to build it, and hopefully we'll become a model in the future for other people looking at how to do this in their community.
What mistakes have you made?
Oh, gosh. I think the mistakes are yet to be made. I mean, I think so far, what we've done right is really engage the community in this discussion. I'm a really firm believer that if you listen to people and you talk and you engage in a meaningful and open community dialogue, that the solutions will be found. People really can kind of help you find the way. And that's how over the last 4 years we've brought this project here, is that we just kept going out and asking people, you know, well, what do you think? You know, here's what we're thinking. What do you think? And people would come back and tell us, and we managed to pick the way to get us here. When I say that mistakes are yet to be made, I think continuing to create this community dialogue and to listen to it as we get into even more complex pieces of the implementation is really critical, because if we stop listening to the community now, you know, I think that we have a lot to risk in this project. But if we continue to keep it open and use community input to guide us as to what people want, I think people will clear the way for this project to go forward.
Ryan, you said that your work was in how infrastructure influences development in mm-hmm. major ways. I'm curious, what are the lessons that you think can be learned from the Beltline project that translate to other cities and other situations? What should other cities learn from your efforts?
Well, I guess just the tying together of the different components of the project, so that, you know, some people like the Beltline because they want an easier way to get to work. They want to ride the train to connect into the MARTA system to get to work or whatever. Some people like the parks. Some people like the trails. Some people aren't going to use any of that, but they like the economic development that it's going to bring. I think tying all of those kinds of things together with affordable housing and everything else, being able to tie all those things together in a public project is really important. I think as cities continue to invest in big infrastructure projects with limited money, they need to accomplish multiple public goals. So I think that's really one thing to take from it. Also, hopefully, ultimately, what Kathy was getting to, I think, is the public involvement process, that we really have built a grassroots effort here. The project has always been, has come from the neighborhood's support. And so hopefully if we can continue that track and keep the project moving forward, then hopefully there'll be lessons to learn about how to include community in determining their own future as other projects come out.
Is the Beltline taking on the same significance that the Olympics had for Atlanta?
Yeah, and I actually think it will surpass it in terms of what it does for individual communities. The Olympics built some great public places for us and certainly got us a lot of national attention and international attention, but the Beltline is going to improve communities at their core for the people who are here day in, day out, and the financial impact will be significant and sustained over the rest of our lifetimes.
Good luck with your work on the Beltline. Thank you both for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Kathy Woolard is Executive Director of Friends of the Beltline, and Ryan Gravel is its Director of Design and Planning. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. City View's commentator Walker Smith has a story of how reimagining an even older form of transportation than railroad has transformed Augusta, Georgia.
The Augusta Canal runs a parallel track to a stretch of the Savannah River, from which it borrows its flow to make its way through the river town of Augusta, Georgia. The Savannah River is the border between South Carolina and Georgia. In the 19th century, the small rapids around Augusta kept commercial boat traffic from reaching town. So between 1845 and 1850, the Augusta Canal was built to bypass these rapids. The canal transformed Augusta, attracting textile mills and iron works. The assurance of power and transportation persuaded the government of the Confederate States of America to locate the Confederate Powder Works in Augusta. After the Civil War, the Augusta Canal continued to attract industry and investors, enabling Augusta to sidestep much of the post-war hardship that plagued the rest of the South. Hydroelectric power from the falling water of the canal powered electric streetcars and streetlights in Augusta, the first city in the South to enjoy these modern amenities. Eventually, though, time took its toll on the canal. Despite extensive repairs to fix the damage caused by major floods in the 20s and 30s, the canal eventually fell into disrepair as textile mills closed and industrial growth moved to other parts of the city and the region. By the 1960s, the canal was so run down that city planners considered draining it and using the dry bed for a major highway. Interest in the canal began to revive in the 70s and 80s. In 1989, the state legislature created the Augusta Canal Authority, which, in 1993, completed a master plan for redevelopment. In 1996, the U.S. Congress designated the Augusta Canal as one of America's National Heritage Areas. Today, the levees and spillways of the upper portion of the old Augusta Canal form an 8.5-mile-long public park filled with walkways, bicycle paths, and picnic shelters that are used for everything from church cookouts to private weddings. Kayakers and canoeists paddle the peaceful waters of the canal itself. Recently, my friend Max and I, along with our wives, spent one bright weekend morning paddling the length of the canal. Our paddle took us through a place of pure tranquility and repose, which I did not expect. The canal borders the city and is crossed at one point by I-20. Yet between its banks, the Augusta Canal is a pocket of serenity. As we dreamily floated the canal, we saw a teeming diversity of wildlife. Flowering plants of every color, as well as river otters, herons, and a surfeit of sunning turtles. Perhaps it reflects our schizophrenic nature that a slice of wilderness can be so easily reclaimed right next door to our civilized cities and streets. It is certainly ironic that an artificial waterway built for industry and commerce is now an escape from these very things. But it is encouraging, too, for it means that we still care about a balanced way of life, even if we can't or won't live that way often enough. It is, at least, a start. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich Partners. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to hear Smart City Broadcast, sign up for our new podcast, listen to archive shows, and register for our weekly newsletter that recaps our discussion and provides links to our guest. Thanks to Charles Edwards at Georgia Public Radio for his production assistance. Jeffrey Reddick edits Smart City. Smart City is a production of WKNO in Memphis. I'm Carol Coletta.